When it comes to digital banking, you can move fast, but please don't break things. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech Demystifying the Digital Economy. I'm Molly Wood. The tech industry is coming for traditional banking. Digital payment apps are changing how we move money around. A wave of so-called neobanks, all digital services that let people do everything on a smartphone without any branches, is cropping up in the U.S. And companies are using new ways to evaluate people for loans. Plus, tech companies like Amazon, Apple, and Uber are offering credit cards or getting into financial services. It is, shall we say, an interesting time to be a banking regulator. Yelena McWilliams is chairman of the FDIC, best known for providing federal insurance to licensed banks. But the agency also has oversight and consumer protection responsibilities. McWilliams told me that, yep, there's a lot going on.
The question for us on a regulatory side is, are we going to be standing in the way of that innovation, or are we going to be open-minded enough while making sure that the banks are safe and sound and there's adequate protection? I do think that the banks of the future are going to be more agile. And I do believe that those banks will service not just the financial needs of the customers, but perhaps expand even above that.
What are the biggest innovations that you're seeing? You know, when these banks say, oh, we're doing this digital innovation, what do they mean, or what are you seeing happening?
Usually what we see is the way that they're able to reach customers and consumers and underwrite models of credit risk by far more quickly and based on alternative data products. That's what we're seeing right now. They're using folks' Starbucks receipts and, you know, how much money is coming in and out of their accounts on a monthly basis to be able to underwrite loans to customers. And that's truly novel because for decades, our credit risk scoring models in the United States have been based on purely the use of credit. So if you have immigrants who are new to this country, if you have folks who are unbanked or underbanked, who had a relationship with a bank, didn't know how to utilize it to their advantage, ended up paying high fees, are now disenfranchised, and they don't go to a bank anymore, they're credit invisibles. And these companies are now able to take a look at, you know, their monthly cell phone bills and how are they paying their rental bills. How are they, shopping for food? There's a twofold approach here. One is that's a lot of private data that these companies are collecting, which if you are really concerned about the privacy and consumer's choice, you have concerns about, right? But there's also an opportunity to say, but this data is very useful if you're looking to bring people into the banking fold. And if you believe that people being a part of the banking system is good for the banking system and good for the people. And I can tell you from a personal experience, I came to the United States with $500. I landed here on my 18th birthday. I immigrated without my parents. And on my second day, I realized I should have a banking account. And so I did. I opened up a banking account, a checking account that I have to this day, 28 years later. And then I realized also as quickly that I should have a credit card because everybody had a credit card. And if you watch infomercials on TV, you should have a credit card. Three easy payments of $7.99 gets you a lot of stuff. And so I applied for a credit card and I was very quickly rejected because I was in the United States for all of a week or 2 weeks. I had no income, no job, no assets, no credit history. And so the bank offered me instead a secured card, and I took $300 of my $500, and I sent it into the bank so I can have a secured card. And now imagine, I had to call my father back in the former Yugoslavia while the country was falling apart in the civil wars, and the banks were closing down, and he lost his life savings waiting in a run on banks, to tell him, remember the $500 you loaned to have me take to the United States? Yes. So I send $300 to the bank. I'm going to borrow money from the bank. The bank is going to hold my money for a year, and I'm going to pay the bank interest on my money. And all of this, Dad, makes sense. It's impossible to explain that concept, but it, you know what? After 12 on-time monthly payments, I was able to get an unsecured card, which then led to me actually being bankable and creditworthy. I was able to establish, you know, good credit history with a good credit score, got an auto loan, home loan, student loan, and I was able to become a part of the system. Now I'm at the point where the system works for me. And by becoming a part of that, of the financial system meant for me as a young immigrant in the United States on my own, meant that I belonged. And so when I pulled that credit card in a grocery store, I looked just like the people around me. And that was my first sense of belonging, the irony of a little plastic heart.
That is remarkable. And I hear you saying that everyone should have that opportunity. And as all these services get more digital, I wonder how much the digital divide starts to really play into that.
Well, the digital divide, actually, I think there is a bridge over that digital divide. And here's why. The FDIC does the unbanked and underbanked survey every few years. And most of those consumers have smartphones or cell phones with some kind of a Wi-Fi capabilities. And they do everything on that cell phone. They use it to communicate. They use that device to move money, to pay their bills, et cetera, et cetera. And this is where some of the disruptors come into play. They're looking at that divide and looking for bridges and figuring out how they can reach the audience of unbanked, underbanked, new immigrants, low and moderate income households that do utilize smartphones and have smart or use Wi-Fi technology in their cell phones, to offer them products and services based on their usage of money, not necessarily just their credit history.
This seems like a good time to jump into cryptocurrency. Can we talk about Libra for a second?
We can't talk about a specific currency because of our regulatory framework, but I'm happy to talk about generally crypto assets and cryptocurrencies.
I mean, where do you see this going? How long is it before a central bank or a government issues a cryptocurrency?
So I know there are talks underway as to what the role of the regulatory bodies in this space is, right? As a regulator, you want to make sure that innovation is able to foster, but at the same time, there are certain developments, such as the crypto assets, that have the possibility to undermine the whole central banking system of a country, right? And we need to make a decision as policymakers, how are we going to look at the crypto assets? One of the things that needs to be decided, you know, is it an asset or is it a security? Is it a currency, right? And if it's a security, we know how to regulate it because we have securities laws. If it's truly a currency, then we need to start thinking about the implications of that, including what does that mean for the deposit insurance?
Are there, do you think, other innovations that can answer some of the needs that, you know, Libra points out, which is a global seamless payment system, the ability to serve the unbanked in an easy and digital way?
So why, every time we see a disruptor, I always ask why. What was the need that this company, especially if they're able to successfully roll out their products and services, why were they able to step in and do this? What was lacking in the marketplace that, you know, somebody planted a seed and there was fertile ground and the seed grew into this product? And so as I looked at the cryptocurrencies and crypto assets, the issue of real payments comes, real-time payments comes into place. Also, the issue of are we able, through digital channels and distributed ledger technology and blockchain, do more and better than we did in the past in terms of how we look at the monetary system within a country? I honestly don't have an answer yet. And one of the things that I want to make sure that we don't do is either bless something we're not sure about and we don't understand its implications for the consumers and the marketplace and the financial stability and systemic risk, frankly. But also, we don't want to encourage, discourage, actually. We don't want to discourage innovation. And it's a fine, I feel like I'm on a seesaw every day. And I'm right there in the middle of the seesaw, one leg on each side, right? Trying to figure out how to create that balance where we do enough to encourage innovation, but we don't do something that would cause the system to irreparably go into disarray.
I mean, it must be difficult. You see these companies kind of plowing ahead. You know, you see people saying the U.S. is so far behind on blockchain. And actually, I would imagine that almost every regulatory body feels this way, that you don't want to get left behind, but you don't want to do it wrong. And the stakes when it comes to global monetary policy are way higher, right?
Yes. I
mean, how stressful is this for you?
Well, it's stressful, all right. Doing laundry is stressful as well in my household. Here's the bottom line.
So laundry is as stressful as Libra. I can write that down?
No. Don't use Libra. Just say crypto assets.
Oh, right. Of course.
Well, if you were in my household, yes. Here's how I look at this. To the extent that these currencies and crypto assets and blockchain are developing to help society be better, We need to take the big picture into equation here, right? As you think about, you know, they're developing, central banks of the world have a very easy job of saying no immediately and stopping all of this in their tracks, right? Every single central bank, I would imagine, has the powers to say no to the rise of the new currency. The fact that that has not happened should tell you that it's a positive development, I think, because the regulators are at least taking the time to understand the implications while analyzing the impact on the system. And so it's stressful because you don't want to make a mistake. You don't want to be that, you know, 21st century regulator that somebody in the 22nd century writes a book and said, oh, we would have been so much further ahead but for Yelena McWilliams at the FDIC, right? So you want to make sure that you're open-minded but careful. And that's why, you know, the agencies, the regulatory agencies need to adjust to the new reality. We need to hire more data science background people. We need to hire more quants. We need to hire people who understand algorithms, who are able to take a look at, you know, distributed ledger and understand each step of the way. They need to understand the implications of blockchain. And so we need to change at the regulatory agencies, because if you really think about it, we're dealing with a 21st century technology with a workforce from generally the 20th century, based in some cases of some regulatory agencies on the laws and organic statutes that were given to us by Congress in the 19th century.
Yelena McWilliams is chairman of the FDIC. And now for some related links. I spoke to Yelena McWilliams at a conference last week in Las Vegas called Money 2020, which is pretty much all about financial technology and was heavily focused on digital banking. I moderated a panel there with three of these so-called neobanks or challenger banks. They're digital only. They're trying to offer more consumer-friendly services than big banks, which means they're focused on things like lower overdraft fees or speeding up how fast you get your paycheck. And consumers definitely want to do this. A new survey on digital banking finds that more than 3/4 of consumers do want to use digital and mobile banking services and actually feel like it's generally safe. But a stubborn 20% or so still want the ability to go into a physical branch and talk to a human or deposit cash on those rare occasions when you sell your car or have a garage sale. Here's a snippet from the panel on that topic. You'll hear me and then Colin Walsh, who's co-founder and CEO of the digital bank Varo.
Like, even Amazon is opening stores. Really no physical locations?
So no, we actually have partnerships with Green Dot and with Allpoint.
Yep.
And so our customers go into CVS, Walgreens, Rite Aid, Walmart, all across the country to be able to get cash through a network of 55,000 free ATMs, and they're all in the app, or they go to deposit cash at any of the 90,000 Green Dot locations. So it's not like we have no physical presence, but we work with our partners to be able to allow people to do some of those essential activities. And then the rest is either through the app or over the phone. And,
right.
And most customers seem completely fine with that are adopting these as their primary bank.
Still have to pay a little bit to deposit your cash, though, right?
For deposit your cash, you're right. But for the ATMs, we don't charge when somebody goes to like a Wells Fargo ATM, and if they get charged a $3 fee, we send them a push notification and tell them that they could have gone to a CVS 2 blocks away and gotten that for free.
That just seems kind of mean, actually, at that point.
But our whole thing is to try to get people to not...
Can I suggest like one grace usage? Like, okay, you accidentally used Wells Fargo, we won't charge you this time?
Yeah.
Just as a consumer.
So we'll look at it.
That was Colin Walsh, co-founder and CEO of Varo. So what do you think? Are you ready to go all digital with your banking? And would you rather do that with an existing bank who you know and probably hate? Or are you ready to give a challenger a try? Email me and let me know. mptech@marketplace.org is the email address, or tweet me @MollyWood. And by the way, for a couple video highlights from that panel, which included Chime, Varo, and the upcoming all-digital business bank, Grasshopper, and of course, more reading on the topic overall, check out our website, marketplacetech.org. I'm Molly Wood, and this is Marketplace Tech. This is APM.